Okay, welcome. Welcome to our village board regular scheduled meeting here on June 9th. It's 7 o'clock. I'd ask the clerk to take the roll call, please.
Trustee Castello?
Here.
Trustee O'Connell?
Here.
Trustee Brennan?
Here.
Trustee Vasquez?
Here.
Trustee Bachner?
Here.
Trustee Gillis?
Here.
President Adusi.
Here. Here. Thank you. Okay. If I can ask everyone to please stand and say the Pledge of Allegiance with us.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right. So right now we have special presentations. We're going to do some swearing in for police department and our firefighter department. So I'd ask Chief Greenwood if he could come to the podium.
Good evening, President Adusi, members of the Village Board, ladies and gentlemen, esteemed colleagues, honored guests, friends and families of our newly promoted leaders, and proud members of the River Forest community. It is an immense privilege to stand before you today to celebrate a momentous occasion in the career of extraordinary leaders, officers whose dedication has profoundly shaped the safety and well-being of our village. First, we have Deputy Chief Michael Swierczynski. Do a little introduction for Chief. Deputy Chief Swierczynski's career at the River Forest Police Department showcases consistent excellence and commitment. He earned Officer of the Year awards in 2006, 2007, 2008, and 2010 for his consistent effort, self-initiated actions, and role in solving significant cases. He was promoted to Sergeant on December 18th of 2015 and graduated from Northwestern University's School of Police Staff Command in 2019. His dedication led to his promotion to Commander on May 16th, 2023, and most recently to Deputy Chief on May 1st, 2025. This promotion reflects his exceptional leadership, strategic vision, and profound commitment to serving River Forest's residents. I ask Madam Clerk to swear Chief Swierczynski in.
Your right hand. I'm Mike Swierczynski.
I'm Mike Swierczynski.
Having been appointed to the office of Deputy Police Chief. In the Village of River Forest.
In the Village of River Forest.
In the County of Cook.
In the County of Cook.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of Illinois.
And the Constitution of the State of Illinois.
And that I will faithfully discharge the duties.
That I will faithfully discharge the duties.
Of the Office of Deputy Police Chief.
Office of Deputy Police Chief.
To the best of my ability.
To the best of my abilities.
Thank you. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Next, we have Commander Marty Grill. I'll wait a second.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Go get the official business done.
Yeah,
we'll forget, and then it'll be a whole thing. Thank you. Commander Marty Grill. Commander Grill began his journey at the River Forest Police Department on April 1st, 1999. He was recognized as Officer of the Year in 2001. His rise to the ranks began with his promotion to Sergeant in November of 2003. He graduated from the FBI National Academy in 2006. In 2010, as a Detective Sergeant, he served as a Street Commander for the Wedge Task Force. He led successful high-profile investigations, earning his team the department's highest commendations. In 2012, he received the Rising Shields of Law Enforcement Award. Most recently, on May 1st, 2025, Commander Grill was promoted to Patrol Commander. Congratulations, Marty. Yep. Madam Clerk.
I'm Martin Grill. Having been appointed to the office of police commander.
Having been appointed to the office of police commander.
In the village of River Forest.
The village of River Forest.
In the county of Cook.
County of Cook.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of Illinois.
And the Constitution of the State of Illinois.
And that I will faithfully discharge the duties.
I will faithfully discharge the duties.
Of the office of police commander.
Of the office of police commander.
To the best of my ability.
To the best of my ability.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Very good.
Next up, we have Sergeant Daniel Humphreys. Sergeant Daniel Humphreys began his service to the River Forest community on May 3rd, 2010. On July 12th, 2015, he demonstrated bravery by neutralizing an armed individual. He has specialized knowledge in traffic safety and accident investigation, completing NEMR training in 2017 and 2018. Since 2018, he has been a key member of the West Staff Multi-Jurisdictional Major Crash Unit. As the dedicated traffic officer for the River Forest Police Department, he also handled directed patrols, accident reports, and proactive traffic enforcement. Dan also coordinated the River Forest Police Department's participation in the Illinois Traffic Safety Challenge, earning awards in 2018 and 2022. On May 1st, 2025, Sergeant Humphreys was officially promoted to sergeant. Congratulations, Dan.
I, Dan Humphreys.
I, Dan Humphreys.
Having been appointed to the office of police sergeant.
Having been appointed to the office of police sergeant.
In the village of River Forest.
In the village of River Forest.
In the county of Cook.
In the county of Cook.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of Illinois.
And the Constitution of the State of Illinois.
And that I will faithfully discharge the duties.
And that I will faithfully discharge the duties.
Of the office of police sergeant.
Of the office of police sergeant.
To the best of my ability.
To the best of my ability.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And just to close, please join me in offering your heartfelt congratulations to Deputy Chief Swierczynski, Patrol Commander Grill, and Sergeant Humphreys. We look forward to their continued leadership and contributions to the safety and prosperity of River Forest. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody, Village Board. I don't have a big intro for our new guy since he just started May 1st. So I'd like to introduce Sam Abizuna. Zena. I've been struggling with trying to remember that all day. But Sam just started with us on May 1st. Just recently tested into Loyola's paramedic system. So we're running him through some training right now, but he's doing a great job so far and look forward to a long, prosperous career here at River Forest. So on that note, Sam.
Raise your right hand. I, Sammy Abuzena.
I, Sammy Abuzena.
Having been appointed to the office of firefighter slash paramedic.
Having been appointed to the office of firefighter slash paramedic.
In the village of River Forest.
In the village of River Forest.
In the county of Cook.
In the county of Cook.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of Illinois.
And the Constitution of the State of Illinois.
And that I will faithfully discharge the duties.
I will faithfully discharge the duties.
Of the office of firefighter slash paramedic.
Of the office of firefighter slash paramedic.
To the best of my ability.
To the best of my ability.
At this time, I'd like to have Sam's wife come up, and she will pin Sam's badge on his uniform.
Oh, right up here. Congratulations.
Good job. Yeah. Yeah.
A couple of them.
There you go.
So I'd like to welcome Sam to our River Forest Fire Department family and wish him luck on a long, healthy, and safe career.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Okay. Okay. Congratulations on all the police officers. And of course, we'll just call him Sam, the firefighter. All right. Next up is the presentation of an award, a Water Ambassador Gold Designation Award. So I'd ask our guest to present.
Good evening, Madam Village President, members of the board, professional staff, and members of the community. My name is Daryl Blennis. I am the Water Utilities Director of the City of Naperville. But tonight, I'm here on behalf of the Board of Trustees for the Illinois Section of the American Water Works Association. The Illinois Section of American Water Works Association provides resources for education of safe and sustainable water. We have 2,400 members across the state and over 50,000 members in our association globally. The Water Ambassador Program was created to elevate public perception, knowledge, and consumer education of the water industry. The program aims to accomplish these goals by presenting a new communication platform of educational and promotional content in a manner that is relevant, engaging, and consistent among participants. The way it works is participating members can access water education tools as well as content from the Illinois Section website and then communicate to their community through social media, the website, bill inserts, newsletters, facility tours, community events, and other means of outreach. There are three levels to this award: bronze, silver, and gold. Each is determined based on their frequency and method of communication. This year, we are awarding 26 gold-level ambassadors and one bronze award throughout the state. So you're in pretty rarefied air as a gold-level community. Thank you to your community for your efforts in educating the public about our water systems and for the work that you do to maintain safe and sustainable water for your residents. I think we like to do pictures if possible. I think that's my task tonight, was to get a photo.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming and presenting this award. The only thing I'd like to say is, obviously, I speak to you guys all the time regarding different public works issues or infrastructure related things. The only thing I'd like to say is, because of Brian Skozak, Superintendent of Operations, and Mike Tomasino, responsible operator in charge, they are key to keeping our water running on a daily basis. So they are the behind the scenes every day. We don't see them, but they're out there working all the time. So that's all I'd like to say. Thank you.
Jack, can I ask a question? Can I just ask a quick question? I'm curious about the kinds of information on water that you are interested in having go out to the community.
So there are multiple levels. So each month, as part of the Illinois Section American Water Works, they have different topics that they like to put together or put out there just regarding water in general. Obviously, tonight we have a water presentation about our infrastructure in particular. And I know last year there was information that was put out to the board just regarding our infrastructure in general. So every community has its own, you know, nooks and crannies and different things that goes with it. But in general, it's just really showing people what's going on behind the scenes that they don't necessarily know. So, yeah. So we try little bits at a time.
Yep.
We got the sign and the awards.
All right.
All right.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you so much. All right. So what do you have the sign up sheet, Sisson? Okay. All right. Great. Thanks, Luke. All right. All right. So. All right. So, Daryl.
That was Daryl.
Right. Okay, Sue. Sue Ferran.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Sue Ferran, and I live at 925 Bonnie Bray. And I just have a simple, I think, administrative question. When will the River Forest Village Code be amended to reflect the term limits for all River Forest Board officials that passed by the majority of River Forest citizens in the April 1st, 2025 election?
I don't have them prepared. Don't have a statement on that. So thank you for the question, though. So Margie Shikander is up next.
Matt, I just wanted to ask about that. Is there anything that we can update the community on?
I don't know why you want to put Matt in that situation. I think I answered it. If you want, we can ask our village attorney. But go ahead, Matt, if you want to answer it. I
seems like it's just code and process. So that's why I was asking Matt, because
go ahead.
I defer to Lance on the next slide.
Okay, so the issue of term limits goes to what's called under Illinois law as the form of government. A municipality, whether it amends its code or not, has nothing to do with the effectiveness of term limits. Some communities put qualifications for office in their code, others don't, but qualifications for office is a state law matter. Term limits are not part of state law. There are no state law requirements. A referendum to add term limits is a change in the form of government. In this particular election, April 1st, there's a question about whether the referendum question, which received a majority of votes, was an advisory referendum or a binding referendum. The actual issue was vague and unclear. But regardless whether it was binding or not, a code amendment doesn't change it one way or another. It can't make it binding if it wasn't. It can't make it advisory if it wasn't.
Okay.
Right. I'm super perplexed by that.
Yeah,
so, and I've been an attorney since 1990, and you don't have to, not that you have to be an attorney to understand this stuff, but can you explain that in layman's terms? I just don't understand what you said.
It's not clear, in my opinion, whether this referendum was binding or advisory, and a code change won't affect it in any event. And so at this point, it's probably not advisable, in my opinion, to add to the code, which would make it appear one way or another. At some point, someone may run for office for a third term or not. If not, it will never be questioned. If somebody does run for a third term after it goes into effect, if it does go into effect, someone may be challenged as being ineligible to run and could be thrown off a ballot if a court were to determine that the referendum question was binding when it received the votes it did on April 1st, 2025.
what makes our situation here in River Forest different from the situations in multiple municipalities around the Chicago area that have voted for term limits? How are we distinguished from those others that have seem to have done it?
How the petition was presented, and the clerk chose not to interpret whether it was one or the other and just sent it in as is. It was the clerk received advice not to send it in at all, because it was our opinion that it wasn't a binding referendum and it was unclear, but the clerk sent it in and it was run by the county as it is. So there's a question.
So has that never happened before in the history of Illinois?
Not to my knowledge. Not that I know of.
What do you recommend that we do?
Nothing. I mean, there's nothing the board can do to change what it is. It's baked into the issue that was voted on.
It seems to me like somebody should be able to determine one way or another whether it is binding or advisory. To me, it would be interesting to hear, besides from you or our legal team, rather than I don't know if you have an opinion on it, and maybe get that.
What my opinion is on what it was?
Well, I think a legal opinion from our attorneys.
Yeah.
So it was our opinion that the question should not have been certified, should not have been sent to the county, that it was inadequate because it was unclear what it was. But it was sent in regardless as it was, and was put on the ballot as it was. And so there's a question about it. I don't believe it was binding.
So you, in a legal opinion, don't believe it was binding. It sounds like our clerk determined that it was, our clerk approved to have it certified. He certified it. The Cook County certified it. So in each instance, neither one seemed to have trouble with it.
Well, it depends on what it is. I mean, it was unclear whether it was either one could have been certified, an advisory or a binding referendum. And this petition had qualities of both.
I feel very uncomfortable with not taking into consideration a vote that our community and our residents put forth and had a majority on.
Okay. All right.
I don't know that we're done with the discussion.
But this is comments. I mean, I think Lance answered the question. If you've got another question, go ahead and ask Lance. But I mean,
so I guess I'll just say, while this is a topic around the table, I feel very uncomfortable about not respecting the majority vote of the residents also. And I guess maybe as a starting point, I know maybe you were put on the spot tonight, but you were prepared. Are you willing to, can we ask you to prepare a written legal opinion so that we can review it and have a better understanding of your analysis and opinion and recommendation on this issue? I would like to have that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we already have one, but so I think give it. Yeah.
Okay. So, well, I have not seen that, so I'd actually like to see both, the one that went to the clerk, and I'd like to see the new one now that.
We all got copies.
Here's what we'll do. So instead of, there's no need, if Trustee Brenn wants one, we'll send it again to her. And
me as well. And, I don't.
Of course. And Megan, you didn't get one. Yes, of course. Yes. And we'll make sure everyone gets everything so that you have it and we can discuss.
Before we table this,
I'd be curious if there are ways that we can address this prior to some unknown point of time in the future. It doesn't seem fair to our citizens to leave it in limbo. It doesn't seem fair to a candidate, future candidate who may want to run, not to have that position clarified sooner rather than later. So I would appreciate if in our legal opinion, we could get some clarification around what legal avenues exist.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what I think the land said. And so we'll make sure that you'll get the legal opinion of the village and the this is a citizens referendum.
Yes.
So so we'll provide that.
Yeah, because I do think the legal opinion, as I recall, that went to all of us with the clerk offered up two or three different options. So as possibilities, and they seem to all be.
Correct. And the clerk chose.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll give you everything. So we'll package that up for you all. Okay. Very good. Margie?
Margie Secunder, River Oaks Drive, 500 block. This board has leftover issues left from the prior board to address, namely the ethics policy rewrite, which the rewrite began March 5th after the Ethics Commission, I'll refer to as EC, found initially the policy was not as they intended nor reviewed in 2022. Within 2 months of being appointed ethics chair, Peggy Daly, at President Ducey's request, began updating the ethics policy to be best in class, according to Ms. Daly's letter to the editor of the Wednesday Journal, August 2nd, 22. Then village attorney forwarded revisions in January of 22, which narrowed and restricted the EC's purview for complaints to only those on prohibited political activities and gift ban, and with no provision for anonymity to the complainant. Yet the ordinance was claimed best in class. The village attorney then was a contractor employed by Kleinthorpe Jenkins, as is the current village attorney. When an ethics complaint was filed against the EDC for recommending a village contract to an EDC commissioner's firm, the ethics ordinance had no mechanism to address complaints outside of those two narrow areas, whether they were submitted by residents, elected officials, staff, vendors, or others. No further meetings to rewrite the ordinance have occurred. The village attorney resisted some revisions in March. Tonight's agenda omits two EC expired appointments. The board needs to investigate why and at whose direction the village attorney made revisions in the January 20, 2022 EC packet, page 16 in the margins. What actions will occur to deliver the thorough, best-in-class ethics ordinance that's been touted? Regarding appointments, 4 years ago, trustees were asked to approve 28 appointments of River Force residents, which had expired 2 months earlier. Trustees discussed at length what their roles should be versus what they were. Trustees' roles to advise and consent is your approval on these appointments. On March 30th, 2024, 9 terms expired. They were filled 10 months later, February 24th. Resulting in invalid votes from those whose terms expired. Tonight, you are asked to advise and consent on 22 openings that expired 6 weeks ago. Only 3 of the 22 are of residents who have not run for office or been appointed, which can lend to the appearance of a group of regulars. 4 years ago, a $1,000 campaign donor was appointed to 2 key village commissions and now being reappointed. Have the changes the trustees wanted in June of 2021 been implemented, and which remain? Regarding term limits, I also had a question. What's the status? Why the wait? Regarding EV charging stations, Chris Burke Engineering, a favorite village vendor, has costed out $1 million gross for 3 charging stations. EV sales are down 6% in April, declined further in May, per Cox Auto. Congress likely will eliminate the $7,500 EV tax credit, further reducing sales. Nearby charging stations sit empty, and state grants could be cut like some of the IDOT's North Avenue funds. Some residents, including condo owners, have installed their own. What is the payback for the net village investment? How long? The board should postpone a decision pending a reassessment of residents' needs in 4 to 6 months, or at minimum, reduce the number to one. And regarding the trees on private property owners can cut and plant, residents could be educated on desirable outcomes and not dictated to by an ordinance that doesn't sell well in River Forest. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, Sheila, regarding Juneteenth. Thanks.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
My name is Sheila Radford Hill. I live at 414 Clinton Place. I have some comments to make regarding Juneteenth, and they basically are thank you comments, but they are also comments regarding what Juneteenth is and why it matters and why it should matter to River Forest. So I want to say to everyone here, there are indeed some flyers in the back. We invite you to the Juneteenth event on June 18th at the River Forest Library, where there will be food, fun, an educational program, and a band, music. We will have a regular celebration, and it will be so much better if you were there. So just make a plan. Now for my comments. 5 years ago, the heinous murders of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd prompted President Aducci and Donna Carroll, then president of Dominican University, to meet to discuss how they could collaborate so that their leadership could take a stand for fairness and inclusion. On June 3rd, 2020, a racial incident in the River Forest Jewel parking lot began in Jewel and escalated into the parking lot, became an altercation that went viral. The white male and the black woman were filmed, and as a result of that encounter, charges were filed. News reports stated that President Aducci condemned the attack, stating that hate had no place in River Forest. Needless to say, the two presidents kept meeting and they were interested in demonstrating a commitment to back up those words. Around the same time, Dominican was partnering with the Anti-Defamation League to combat anti-Semitism after swastikas were found on campus and graves were desecrated at Waldheim Jewish Cemetery. Students were demanding a cultural space and courses that included the concerns and contributions of LGBTQ plus students were also being levied. The need for strong winds of welcome in the River Forest community led Donna to talk to me and to introduce me to President Aducci. Out of Kathy's leadership and the trustees' support came such things as the Maywood Covenant and a welcoming community resolution. At the Leadership Lab, sponsored by the Oak Park Chamber of Commerce, Trustee Brennan and a few lab alumni decided that they would work together and create an ongoing initiative to accomplish these similar goals of welcoming and standing against hate. Mm-hmm. Juneteenth became that perfect expression of what we needed. Juneteenth, I remind you all, is a national holiday. It's the day when slavery in America ended in fact and later in law with the passage of the 13th Amendment. To a few of us, Juneteenth is an opportunity to stand for what we want our community to be. Several municipalities have joined in this wonderful Juneteenth celebration and showing the importance of including all of our communities and providing support for Juneteenth in the western suburbs. So we're not alone. We're just pretty good at what we're doing because we've been doing it now for 4 years. River Forest volunteers approached the River Forest Public Library and asked for a partnership. And in an era of book bans and organized support for whitewashing history, a small group has worked to raise the official Juneteenth flag over our village hall and the River Forest Library. We have a resolution about this on the agenda tonight. I'm grateful for that because this is the time when we must decide what our America is, what it means to us, what it means to our children, and what we want to celebrate as far as national independence is concerned. Again, I'm here to thank the village president, the trustees, the village administrative staff for their commitment and hard work, to acknowledge the library, its leadership, and its staff, and to thank our small but mighty group of dedicated volunteers. And here I might add, you can be a dedicated volunteer as well. Just let me know. I want to thank the women-owned and minority vendors who will be present at the event so that residents can take their wares, taste their wares, and see their products. And most of all, I want to thank the Village of River Forest. We are grateful for the support of this event and proud to live in a village that is committed to being inclusive and equitable. Our community knows that freedom, welcoming, and fairness are within our reach. Let's go, River Forest.
Yeah. Sheila, you never disappoint. Thank you so much. John Keith.
Hi, my name is John Keith. I live at 407 Ashland. And I'm just bringing up, because I don't have a copy of the minutes and all that, where the property on Lake and Lathrop stands and what's going on and what are we pursuing there. And also to Ms. Jillian's remarks about vendors of women-owned and minority vendors, what's wrong with white owners? Why aren't they included? Why shouldn't all vendors be included? Because to me, that's not working as unity. That's segregation. And that's what I have to say.
Okay. Thanks, John. All right. That concludes our comments from the citizens. I will go to the elected official comments and announcements. So I'll start with you, Bob, if you don't mind.
Rom, thank you. I just got a couple things just real quick. Number one, I want to congratulate the Park District, the Kiwanis, and as importantly, our village staff for their participation in the Memorial Day Parade. It was a great event. It was a nice day. We almost got through the parade in a rapid manner, but thanks again to everybody. And then I just wanted to reach out. I know Lisa, Trustee Gillis, had sent out some notes on this, but we had a couple of sewer water bursts over on the 1100 block of Keystone. And I know Jack and his team were all over it. You know, they had one. And then as a result of that, another one kind of happened. And they were Johnny on the spot. And, you know, again, doing a great job getting the service back up. And congratulations to you and your team, Jack. That was it.
Okay. Thanks, Bob.
I'd like to say thank you to everyone for your support of our fourth annual Pride and Inclusion Walk. Like Juneteenth, we're in our fourth year coming out of the same spirit. It was attended by more than 500 people, and the move to Keystone Park and inclusion of Opalga, PFLAG, way back in the township, the library, and our religious organizations was very well received. So I just want to say thank you to everyone for their support. Congratulations to all of our recent graduates of eighth grade, high school, and college. I've seen a lot of wonderful signs around town. I know everyone is very excited, and happy Father's Day to all of our dads. And when you go over to the library for Juneteenth, it's a great time to sign up for summer reading. They have programs for kids, teens, and adults.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Great reminders.
Katie?
Yep, thank you. Well, inspired by our former trustee, Ken Johnson, at our last meeting, I would like to take my part in reading the land acknowledgement tonight. Okay. So as we begin, we are mindful that we hold these meetings on land that was once and still is inhabited by Indigenous people, including the Ojibwa, Chippewa, Menominee, Potawatomi nations, and more. We will remember our nation's history and honor the Native people as stewards of this land that was colonized, and that River Forest continues to be a place many people from diverse backgrounds live and gather. Sheila, thank you. I'm so glad you're still here. Thank you so much for being here tonight and for your comments and for being an instrumental part of River Forest hosting a Juneteenth event for the past 4 years. Not only does Sheila help organize it every year, but she also has given our keynote address at the event every year. And if you appreciated her comments tonight, you'll really appreciate what she has to say on the 18th at 4 o'clock at the River Forest Library. All the trustees should have one of these, and everyone is invited. I hope that you can come. We did change the time this year from the middle of the day to 4 p.m. in the hopes that more people can attend. I also attended the Pride event and want to congratulate you and thank Megan and Erica, but and everyone else who was involved in organizing, because you really had an awesome turnout. And a pretty day. And then I also want to circle back to two items that I think were raised at the community conversations meeting, which I attended since our last village board meeting, and ask staff if we can get those back on the agenda, because I haven't seen anything about these in a while. The first is the leaf blower ordinance that came to our board months ago from the Sustainability Commission, and our board made comments and suggestions for the Sustainability Commission to revise that proposed ordinance, and we haven't seen it. Meanwhile, Oak Park has enacted theirs. So I would like to see that those changes to the draft ordinance come back to our table, or to understand what's happening, because we haven't heard a report on that.
Yeah. Susan's here. I mean, we'll get a report. And we'll follow up on.
So I'm looking for that. And then the second thing I'm looking for to circle back on is the affordable housing plan, which years ago, I think it was my first year as a trustee, maybe 2019, this board passed an affordable housing plan. And it was sent to a village commission to draft an ordinance, and it never came back to our board. So I don't know why. I don't know what the situation was, but I would like to hear what happened, and I'd like to see it come back to our board.
I think it was the accessory dwelling units.
No, we had an affordable housing. We'll need to talk about it, but there was an affordable housing plan,
right,
part of the comprehensive plan. I don't know if it would have. Or was.
It was separate from the right. Comprehensive plan.
Right. But I mean, it was part of that whole discussion. So we'll look into that, Katie, for you and get back to you. I don't think it was ever an ordinance. I think it was just a plan, if I can recall.
There was a plan adopted by the board.
Yeah, plan that was adopted by the board.
And we sent it to a commission to prepare an ordinance and come back to us, was my understanding.
I think so. But I don't believe so. I believe it was the plan that... For
the accessory dwelling units was one of the recommendations from the affordable housing plan that was raised to the Zoning Board of Appeals and was not recommended for approval. So that was kind of held up through that zoning process. That specific piece of the affordable housing plan, the larger plan was approved by the village board in 20
2019 or 2020.
Yeah. You were part of.
And we'll be revisiting that here soon.
Right.
Yeah. So, I would like to hear what happened when it left our board and went to the commission, because there was – and we can go back to the minutes and the audio and listen to it to understand completely. Right. But it was supposed to come back to our board, and it didn't. So I would like to see that. And it sounds like you already have it in your sites.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll give you a kind of a blow by blow on what happened in terms of timeframes and timetables. Because I think what you're referring to, the ADUs were discussed, was part of the plan, right, and that was brought to the zoning board. And the zoning board denied it. But there's other pieces of that plan that I think maybe you're referring to that we should also talk through, which is what, but I don't think it's an ordinance. I think it was a plan that we approved, and maybe your question is, where are we? Which is a good one.
So I look forward to getting the whole story and seeing where we stand.
Just as a reminder, can
we wait and just we'll get to you? Go ahead if you want to talk about that. It's on yours too.
Part of the comments, but just it is Illinois state law that we have this plan because we are under the amount. So I hear comments, and we should be continually working on this to try to get to at least a standard that Illinois is trying to set.
Well, it's federal law. 10% is. So
we have the plan that was approved by the village board.
We have it. We'll get to it. I mean, go ahead. Answer.
No, but it is due to be updated. A conversation will have to come forward soon, and we can discuss what the other pieces were and what the status is.
All right.
That's all I have.
Rosa?
I just would like to wish everybody a happy Father's Day this upcoming Sunday, and I hope the weather holds out for everybody.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. Chris?
Okay. A couple of thank yous. I want to thank our River Forest Fire Department during Senior Week for their free breakfast. That was a success, so thank you for that. Also, again, joining Trustee O'Connell about the Memorial Day Parade. I did attend with a number of us, and it was a successful event. So I do want to thank the Kiwanis, the River Forest Park District, the Chamber, of course, the village staff who put a lot of work into it as well. And then also, I do want to thank also Sheila, the village, whoever, and the library who put together the Juneteenth. Because this will be the first time I'm able to go, because it was rescheduled at a time in the evening where before it was at noon, and that was fine. It wasn't critical, but it's hard for us who work, us particularly outside of the village, to be able to attend it. So thank you all, and I'm planning to come this time around. And then just a friendly reminder, everybody, the village vehicle stickers, they're coming due. So you have to have them by July the 14th. So just a friendly reminder about that. So, okay, thank you. That's it.
Thanks, Russ. Lisa?
Okay, I have two things. First, just to build on the Memorial Day Parade, there was the business bash. It was the first one. I really hope we do it again. Per the director of the Oak Park River Forest Chamber of Commerce, all of the makers and vendors who participated hit their goals. So they were very excited about it and, again, are looking for, do it again next year, make it bigger, better. It was great. Second is thank you, Trustee O'Connell, for talking about the water main breaks on Keystone. It's in my backyard, so it was a rough, actually, week, because we had a water main break on Tuesday. We didn't have electricity on Wednesday due to a transformer blowing. And then on Thursday, we had another water main break. So I did send out, I responded to a resident who had concerns and had sent those concerns to everybody. I also then posted it on the Keystone Triangle Facebook page, which is a private Facebook page. So I just wanted to read it because I learned a lot in talking with Jack. And I do want to thank Jack and the Public Works team because they did do a great job. But basically, I'm just going to read it. The River Forest Public Works Department tracks all water main breaks across the village. A summary of break history for the past three fiscal years. Our fiscal year start on May 1st. As the current fiscal year are, in fiscal year 23, we had 6. Fiscal year 24, we had 8. Fiscal year 25, we had 7. And fiscal year 26, which as of today, we've had 2. Both of them, you know, literally feet from each other. The two water main breaks on Keystone and Division are not related to one another. Everybody's like, oh, they must be related. They're not. Water main breaks happen for a variety of reasons, but in this case, the Public Works Department believes that the age of the pipe and the material that the pipe was made of were key drivers. The water main in this area is an older pipe made of cast iron, which is prone to corrosion, thereby weakening the pipe. The good news is the 39.5 miles worth of water mains will, you know, our goal is to replace them, but we have to prioritize. You can't do 39.5 miles all at once. So prioritization of water main replacement across the village is based upon what pipe is in the ground, cast iron, ductile iron, or PVC, the pipe size, 5-inch or 8-inch. Actually, I thought it was 6-inch or 8-inch, but then the pipe was 5. Okay. So 6-inch or 8-inch, the pipe age and pipe break history. I guess the good news with Keystone, we hit the lottery since we had 2 breaks. We're now a top priority. The section, okay. I will also say a few neighbors have raised concerns about water mains being made of lead. This kind of leads into the whole lead replacement initiative, which is separate. There is no concern because water mains are not made of lead. They're either made of cast iron, ductile iron, or PVC. Individual service lines are made of lead, and that's why we have a separate initiative. And if you do have questions regarding water main replacement, you can talk to Jack. And I know Jack is going to do a whole presentation this afternoon, or this evening, I should say, about kind of the water mains in our town and, you know, how we maintain them and what the, you know, vision is for, you know, kind of their upgrade where necessary. So thank you for allowing me to kind of give that brief update.
Is that all? Thank you, Lisa. Erica?
I just want to thank everyone for their participation, volunteering at the Memorial Day Parade. It was a huge success, as always. Really enjoyed the business bash, getting to meet a few vendors who are in our area, folks I didn't know about, like Jilly's Jerky, which was really cool for my husband in particular. And I know there are a bunch more, so I'm really looking forward to seeing more next year. Also want to thank everybody for the Pride Parade and the flag raising, the volunteers who came through, in particular, the children and the parents. We had high schoolers who helped put together the balloon arch. We had kids as young as kindergartners up to high schoolers make signs for the Pride Parade and then hand them out to people during the parade. Keystone was so wonderful. I got all these comments on how it was great to be there. I feel like a broken record, but it gets bigger and bigger every year. And thank you to anybody on the village board who was able to make it that night as well. We even got Fox 32 out to come and report on the parade. And Megan Cascatallo gave a great interview. Want to thank John Beckfar from the Village Township, who was also interviewed in that. We now will have the flag raised for the month of June. And We did have a little bit of a snafu with our sound system this year. So I'd like to read my speech that I gave during the event, just so that people can hear it this time. So, good afternoon, everyone. What an incredible day to come out in celebration, in community, and in pride. Today, we raise the Progress Pride flag and step off this beautiful parade. We are reminded of the power of visibility and the importance of showing up for one another. I'm especially proud to be standing here together with two other LGBTQIA elected officials, three of us together, hosting the event, not just as leaders, but as members of this vibrant and powerful community. That representation matters, and that it sends a message, especially to our young people. And to the kids and teens here today, especially those who are queer, trans, non-binary, or questioning, know this: we love you, we support you, and we see you. You belong here just as you are. When we walk in this parade, we're not just celebrating, we're taking a stand for inclusion, for safety, for joy, and for the future everyone can thrive in. So let's raise this flag high, let's lift each other up, and let's keep showing the world what it means when love, justice, and pride lead the way. Happy Pride, everyone.
Yay.
That's it.
Okay. Okay, great, Erica. So let me address one thing real quick. Since I set the agenda, I agree with Erica and Katie. Let's get, I think we all deserve an update on the affordable housing plan. And so we will get that on our next agenda. We'll do an update and then kind of a direct where it's all going. So I think that's a great suggestion. Okay, a couple things. Again, just to echo what everybody else said, we had a fabulous Memorial Day parade. Couldn't have asked for like a better weather. You know, the Kiwanis were great. Park District was great. Everybody was just great to work with. So on behalf of the Village Board and, of course, the trustees, we really appreciate partnering with the Kiwanis and the Park District to make that a very successful Memorial Day. And, of course, the Business Bash, which just added a huge benefit to the parade. And I think a lot of our residents, you know, were happy that they could stay longer. So that was a good success. Thank you, Sheila, for the shout out on the Juneteenth. And of course, Katie's leadership at the Leadership Lab. I think, you know, Juneteenth, I don't know if people recognize it, but we actually put it in our employee handbook just recently, and the trustees approved it unanimously to not only recognize, but have it as a holiday for our community, and that is a major step forward. So I think you should thank the Village trustees and, of course, the Village staff for acknowledging that and showing it through our employee handbook. So I'm looking forward to being part of that once again. So thank you again, both of you, for making what it is today. I also was asked to be part of a community capstone, which is Roosevelt Middle School. They're eighth graders. They're so cool, to give a little bit of, I guess, a presentation on government and how government works. So it's pretty interesting. But they were really great questions. And I think this is my third one I've done so far. And boy, I think we've got some leaders coming up through the ranks. So I'm really impressed of the type of questions and the interest that they're having. So if any of you all have any chance to you know, give a presentation or do an update, boy, they're just sponges. So, and that's all. And again, thank you to Megan and Erica and John for putting together a great Pride walk. It was wonderful to see so many people come out. So that's all I have. And again, happy Father's Day. And with that, we'll move on to our consent agenda. So if I can get a motion and a second to approve our consent agenda A through.
Can I ask before you make the motion that we pull one item from that?
Yeah.
To discuss separately. And that would be the last item, L, award of contract Lake Street Traffic Calming Engineering Design.
Okay. So we'll do A through K.
Motion to approve consent agenda items A through K.
Second.
Okay. Any comments or questions regarding those items? Hearing none, I'll ask Rosa to, of course, read out loud and then take the vote, each item.
A, Village Board of Trustee meeting minutes, May 12th, 2025. B, monthly department reports. C, administration department report. D, accounts payable, May 2025, $2,800,700.69. E, May financial report. F, Juneteenth flag raising resolution. G, recognition of Pollinator Week proclamation. H, authorization of sale, destruction of surplus property, police department surplus firearms. I, intergovernmental agreement renewal with IDOT, maintenance of municipal streets, resolution. J, a right-of-way encroachment waiver and agreement for an irrigation system in the public right-of-way with the property owners at 1346 Forest Avenue. K, purchase approval, fire department, 2025 Ford Escape, Curry Motors, $34,116.42.
Okay. Trustee Cascatello?
Yes.
Trustee Vasquez?
Yes.
Trustee Brennan?
Yes.
Trustee Bachner?
Yes.
Trustee O'Connell?
Yes.
Trustee Gillis?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So now we'll move on to L. If I get a motion in a second, and then we can discuss it further.
Motion to approve the consent agenda item L.
Second.
I knew you were trying. So Megan, second. All right. So, yes, Katie.
So I wanted to discuss this separately because this is the first that I've seen that, as I understand it, the Traffic and Safety Commission has gathered information to determine where we need traffic calming measures on Lake Street, and has made a determination about where we need those. And then we need to apply for a permit, or we need to get permission from IDOT in order to do that, because it's an IDOT-owned street. And so what we're voting on here is to approve a contract with a third party, Gewalt, if that's how you say the name, to prepare the request to IDOT, and then for Gewalt to design the traffic calming measures. And then separate from that, we're also, this vote, I think, also includes money that we would be approving to ask Gewalt again to research and give us a report on whether what the economic implications would be for the village if we approached IDOT and asked if we could take over jurisdiction, essentially ownership responsibility of Lake Street, because they own it right now. Do I have that right?
You do. Exactly right. So yes, the first step would be Gewalt Hamilton will be designing the analyzing those intersections that have been identified as problem intersections along Lake Street, surveying and designing the curb extensions or the refuge islands or the things that will help address those issues. They'll take those designs and guide us through the process with IDOT to get through the permitting process, similar to what we went through on Harlem and Greenfield and Harlem and Lemoyne for the right in, right out there. So those are the first two steps. And then separately, there was some discussion at the village board earlier this year about exploring a jurisdictional transfer. This would mean that the IDOT-controlled road would be taken over by the Village River Forest, where we would be able to make changes there. Now, I think our primary goal is to make the route safer for pedestrians and vehicles, and we believe that the proposed improvements will help that. In the event that that IDOT were to not approve any changes or push back on what is proposed, then I think there's a discussion to be had at that time with the village board about whether we want to pursue that jurisdictional transfer. So this is just because we're having the conversation, we want to have that in our back pocket if we ever wanted to get to that point. But our hope is that with the design and the permitting process, we think these are great projects and needed at these intersections, that IDOT will agree with that, allow for the projects to go through, and the corridor will be safer. And then we might not necessarily need to pursue a jurisdictional transfer, where we'd be responsible for the maintenance and all the costs associated with that for the length of Lake Street.
Thanks for that. And I, by part of your explanation answered another, one of the questions that I had, which was, why aren't we applying to IDOT ourselves? Why are we using a third-party contractor? But I think that maybe the answer is we need the design from the third-party contractor in order to prepare the application to IDOT.
Exactly right. Yes.
Okay.
You got it.
Yeah. Probably would have been easier to say, Jack, could you explain? But that's all right. We went
He's
through
got it. A presentation later, yeah. So I'll give him a break
it.
For now.
Right.
I do have one question about it. Do we have a sense of time frame once that goes to IDOT?
So that's partially why we're, I guess I would say, doing this aggressive schedule, is that our hope is that, because IDOT's review timeframes are anywhere 3 to 6 months. So my hope is get this consultant in, get the work started, get it going so that we can get it into their queue so that I can start bothering them about, hey, hurry up, give me an answer. So, right. Yeah.
Yeah, the timing is of import to me as well, because I know things can take a while sometimes. So if it's going to take like a year, if it's going to take longer than that with just the permit process, I would want to see the us do our analysis of what it is to get the road back to us and like all the different, you know, what that means for us, the costs and everything. At the same time. So I feel like if it's not happening around 3 to 6 months, or we're not seeing anything, that maybe we should be starting then, because as I understand it, what the packet says is only after the permit process is over would we consider.
No. The how this is packaged, and we kind of went back and forth on whether to do that, these would be kind of a parallel process.
Would be. Okay.
Now, not a parallel process for the analysis to be performed, not necessarily pursuing a jurisdictional transfer.
Okay. So we would be doing the analysis at the same time, but not necessarily pursuing it. Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
And I think that process can be very extended as well. I think we could.
Yeah, the jurisdictional transfer process is extended as well. And as Matt mentioned a little bit, the end goal for us is really just slowing down traffic on Lake Street. So regardless, we need to start the design. We need to start going through that process. So that needs to get going. And then after, if we need to pursue the jurisdictional transfer, that can start.
I just have actually one question related to, we have a specific design. And is that because IDOT only lets you do certain things on the street?
So the hope is that given the current areas that we're looking to do, so if everyone's noticed, we have delineators out there currently. Mm-hmm. Those delineators are currently in medians that are striped. So those are not supposed to be traversed anyways. So my hope is that if we implement raised medians and we do stuff like that, we're not necessarily changing the way traffic is operating. We're just creating more of a physical barrier. So my hope is that that's easier to get through rather than what we did on Lemoyne and Greenfield, where we're sort of changing the way traffic is moving, because we were right in, right out, compared to just basically raising or creating more prominence to what's already there.
I noticed in the contracts, maybe I didn't quite read it correctly, but it looks like they're providing us with sort of a layout of curb bump outs, but it didn't seem like there was anything for the medium raise, which...
So the intended... the intended scope would be at Edgewood. You're looking at curb extensions similar to the 5 that we currently have. At Jackson and William, we're looking at medians. The medians where people do the crossing, where it's currently striped. And then at Franklin, we're looking at implementing an RRFB near the school. Rapid reflective flashing beacon, RRFB.
Jack, can you go through the process of how we determined what locations? Because I know we've heard a lot from the community on this, but as I was hearing from communities, at like the community conversations, and just from people in general, it occurred to me that like we should just, and we are obviously like taking a look at Lake Street in full, right? So was there anything that you saw that maybe hadn't been discussed? Did you compare other locations to the locations that we're talking about tonight and see like what their rates of accidents were and that kind of thing?
So as I mentioned a little bit, I guess the way that these locations in particular came up at a number of the community conversations, Lake Street in general was brought up. One particular location continually came up, William Street. When that continually came up, well, right away, it's like, well, we don't need to just, you know, you don't just pick a location and do that. You need to start looking at, okay, well, how's the whole corridor performing? So at that time, then we got into the history of Lake Street and what was done previously to make any improvements along the corridor. And as I mentioned, there were five already curb extension projects that were done in 2010, Keystone, Forest, and I'm not going to try to name the other three. But there are five locations that were done at that time. To build off that, the only remaining locations that didn't really have traffic calming measures in place, Edgewood, Jackson, William, Franklin actually already has curb extensions. The only change here, it does already have just standard crossing signs. The only reason for this improvement or potential improvement is because of the school being located right there and this being a primary crossing.
Sounds good. So we've you're seeing that the traffic calming measures at the other locations are working.
Yes, yeah. I definitely believe, particularly Edgewood. I see it on Jackson significantly because of that pace stop, bus stop that's right there. I do see the value, especially by Edgewood, because of the way that cars typically are not parked. It looks like it's a 4-lane highway, but because of these delineators being in place, it really notifies the driver early on of you need to, you know, squeeze in, and this is a one way each direction. So it seems to be working.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Jack, another question for you. How does this proposal impact the bike lane that covers a couple blocks, I believe, on Lake Street?
It would be the same as what it is currently, because the bike lanes on Lake Street would be like shared locations. So that would be similar to what's already out there in terms, because the bump outs or the curb extensions that we're doing at, in particular at Edgewood, would just match what we have at the other five.
So I think on Lake Street, there's a designated bike lane, not a sharrow, a designated bike lane that goes for one or two blocks.
Okay. And that is particularly something when you talk about, permanent fixtures, in particular, when we look at like Jackson or William, it has no impact because everything that we're changing currently is going into just existing striped medians. So like for Jackson and Williams, those are not meant to be crossed as it is today. Like those are not meant to be traversed by vehicles, but vehicles are using those as ways to get around people. And that's what's creating the danger when people are crossing. For those two.
Right.
For Edgewood, in particular, the only reason or the difference there is we're taking an extension of where there's currently parking, and all we're doing is making that more, we're making a curb extension so that it's making the parking spaces more prominent so people aren't using parking lanes to get around people.
Right.
So that the particular location that you're talking about that's a block or two, I will look at that more in depth, but in particular, the locations I'm bringing up, those are not changing any existing traffic pattern.
Yep. My recollection is that it's near Jewel. It might be the Jewel Kirk Eye Center block that has a designated bike lane. And just do take a look, make sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Easy. All right. Well, this is our time to, if you want, we can talk later at whatever your question is.
Sure.
Okay, any further questions from the board? Hearing none, I'd ask the clerk to read out loud the award and then take the vote.
Item L, award of contract, Lake Street Traffic Calming Engineering Design, Gewalt Hamilton Associates, $64,744. Trustee Cascatello?
Yes.
Trustee Vasquez?
Yes.
Trustee Brennan?
Yes.
Trustee Bachner?
Yes.
Trustee O'Connell?
Yes.
Trustee Gillis?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you so much on that. So we're going to move on to boards and commissions. Okay. So if I can get a motion, again, these are as a roles and responsibility, to propose appointments and reappointments.
Kathy, I'm going to ask you to take, do a separate vote
for Rick.
Eight, yes, okay. E3.
Yeah. E3, yes. Okay. Eight, Okay, so I'm asking the board to move in second items A all the way, everything but E3.
Okay. I move to consent to the village president's proposed appointments and reappointments to the village's boards and commissions, 8A through J, all and related subparagraphs or items excluding 8E3.
Second.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, any questions or comments on these appointments and reappointments?
I actually have a question. Being the new kid on the block, I recognize this won't happen now. I'd love to see resumes for the people that we're voting on. It's a lot of names without a lot of information for someone who may not know them personally or have worked with them before.
Yes, you're asking for resumes. Yes. And I think they're all in there.
There's one resume in the packet and a few statements of background. I'd love to have a little more information
Go ahead.
So, Trustee Cascatello, now it's a requirement for applicants to submit a resume. That wasn't the case until recently. That came up at a village board meeting. So a lot of those statement of interest was pulled from when folks had come forward and made their initial things. It was just kind of a basic form that had some background. So that's what we had and shared it. But I think the process going forward now, new applicants will have their resumes.
Thank you. Yep.
Does it make sense to ask old applicants to submit, to adhere to the new rule?
I mean, we can. I mean, there's no reason we can't ask. See who sends them in.
Makes sense to me. If we have a rule that some have to adhere to and some don't, I mean, it'd be nice to... The rule was made for a reason. So
yeah, but it's because,
why don't we ask... for equal information from all the applicants that we would be voting.
That's fine. That's fair. That's fair. Okay. Any further questions? Hearing none, I'd like to take the vote, please.
This is voting on items.
Yeah. Just call the vote.
Yeah. Okay. Trustee Gillis.
Yes.
Trustee O'Connell? Trustee Bachner?
Yes.
Trustee Brennan?
Yes.
Trustee Vasquez?
Yes.
Trustee Cascatello?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Now we want to have a motion to move E3, which is Rick Gillis.
Make a motion to approve item 8E3.
Okay. Do I hear a second?
Second.
Thank you. Any questions regarding this item? Hearing none.
You could take the vote. Okay. Trustee Cascatello?
Yes.
Trustee Vasquez?
Yes.
Trustee Brennan?
Yes.
Trustee Bachner?
Yes.
Trustee O'Connell?
Yes.
Trustee Gillis?
I abstain.
Abstain.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I appreciate it. We'll move on to Sustainability Commission. Presentation regarding climate action plan. There's no action. We got Susan here. Congratulations on your reappointment.
So this was the initial update I was planning to give last month's meeting, the previous meeting. So you guys may recall, spring of 2024, we partnered with UIC. Go to the first slide. Oh, I was there. There we go. Partnered with the University of Illinois Chicago and two sections of a class in their graduate level plan making class, developed climate action plans for the village. In total, the two reports totaled 75 recommendations, number of climate related topics, natural environment, land use, transportation, resilience, resource management, buildings, energy, and community engagement. I will note, because these were two separate class sections, there was a lot of overlap in the terms of the topics and even some of the specific recommendations. One of the recommendations that was done, was to conduct a village-wide survey to collect baseline resident knowledge on climate change topics. In the fall, the Sustainability Commission on their own developed this survey. They developed the questions on their own. You know, I sort of just helped format that into a survey form, but put it out on the village social media, newsletters. It was open through February. In total, we got 331 resident respondents. Some of the key takeaways, one of the last questions was we asked residents which topics they would be interested in. That's the bar graph over to the side there. The two sort of most overwhelmingly popular topics were green space and urban forestry, and then local wildlife and biodiversity. Range of interest in other issues as well. And then throughout, both in specific topic-related questions and at the end, residents were able to provide their own written input in addition to the sort of yes, no, sort of scale rating level things. Based on those written comments, just sort of anecdotally, some of the big takeaways were there was a lot of skepticism regarding effectiveness of recycling programs generally. And that's something that the Sustainability Commission's really focused a lot of their communications on since then. And then I don't know if it's concern is the best way to do it, but a lot of confusion, just residents unsure of the cost, the electric capacity, and the effectiveness of electrification of whether it be electric vehicles, electrification of appliances, home energy. Just the topic generally seemed to have less understanding and more concern from residents than a lot of the topics presented. So with communications, the Sustainability Commission obviously has a sustainability post every week on the village social media, puts things out in the monthly and weekly newsletters. 17 of the recommendations of those 75 could be incorporated into our existing communications process. And just for your all awareness, these were very broad recommendations, like provide climate change education materials to residents, to very, very specific recommendations like connect residents with resources to install a rain barrel. So that latter of which we do have links to the MWRD's rain barrel ordering thing on our sustainability portion of the village website. So Sustainability Commission has since continued to develop sharing information resources, developing specific guides, encouraging activities and participation in existing programs that are out there, both sponsored by the village or just available to any residents of the region. In February, the month of February specifically, all of the Sustainability Commission's communications were specifically focused on recycling. We used the monthly newsletter that time to highlight the tour that Susan and a number of the commissioners at Manolo's here as well. They went to the LRS facility in Chicago and toured the recycle sorting facility there. So able to provide some great pictures of sort of what happens when you put all your materials in your recycling bin, and then really provide a lot of information about the effectiveness of that recycling program, where most of the things that go in there, unless it's, you know, a tiny piece of plastic too small, really does end up getting recycled and repurposed into something further down the recycling stream. And then we also provided just short blurbs on items that were more specific things not collected as part of the curbside recycling program. So plastic bags, plastic films cannot be collected in our curbside carts, but there are drop-off locations both at retail stores and at a number of the churches and faith-based groups around the community, and I believe at Oak Park River Forest High School. that do that. There is specific textile recycling programs. Some programs will even come to your house and pick up textiles to be then recycled for free. So we promoted that. And then I did want to give a special plug, which I did, we did in the month of February, to the Cook County Center for Hazardous or Hard to Recycle Materials. CHARM is the acronym. It's based in the South Suburb, but it's free and open to all Cook County residents. I believe they're open Saturdays and Sundays, typically in any sort of hard to recycle material you can drop off there, and they will take it and recycle it because they can collect those items in bulk. And then one of the first sort of communications guides undertaken. There is a new guide to trees in the sustainability portion of the Village webpage, links to some region-specific tree planting and tree care information, information on the benefits of trees. I cannot think of the name of the app. Susan actually was the one who brought it to the commission, but you can put in the information about the trees you have on your property, and mm-hmm. you can see the stormwater capture, the carbon capture of it, all of the various benefits of the trees in your own backyard or your own front yard. So it's a really cool tool. And then, again, promoting the MWRD Restore Our Canopy program, which MWRD gives away free oak saplings, I believe, once a month from pickup at any of their facilities throughout the county. A number of the recommendations could or were already sort of folded into existing operations and ongoing projects. There was a heavy focus. One of the plans had a sort of six-step process about expanding our EV charging stations. That's obviously an ongoing project that we will be discussing about in more detail in the next few minutes. Utilization and promotion of permeable pavers, something we have already done with our village alleys and that we are hoping to partner with MWRD to do with the village parking lot here at Village Hall. And then one of the recommendations was updating energy efficiency standards in our building codes, and just upon investigation, it was actually already within our building codes we have adopted. So there was a lot of wins there. As I mentioned, forestry and biodiversity were two of the biggest interest items of residents in the survey. In addition to the tree guide, both of the plans made recommendations about expanding the village's tree preservation ordinance to further preserve the tree canopy. So over the past several months, Sustainability Commission has been reviewing our existing ordinance, which is within the village zoning code, and then what other communities have done. Both the plans provided numerous examples of other communities in the region and what their tree preservation ordinances are. And then there are a number of different programs to promote wildlife and biodiversity. One that we were made aware of this spring that the village is now participating in is the National Wildlife Federation's, I have a typo in my presentation, I'm just seeing now, Mayor's Monarch Pledge. It's no cost to the village. It simply asks to commit to three things. One, demonstration project, which our Chicago Avenue bioswales will serve as. And then the other two, we are promoting communication. So you all just adopted a proclamation for Pollinator Week. National Pollinator Week is actually the 16th through the 22nd of June. And we will have something up on social media. We also have an active webpage on the village website. So if you go to vrf.us/mayorsmonarchpledge, we have information about the village's commitment and then what residents can do. Lots of resources to West Cook Wild Ones, a lot of the national organizations on any residents interested in developing their own pollinator gardens. Looking ahead, this commission's really focused on continued communications and events, looking at opportunities to partner with the library, with D90 Green for Good. One of our sustainability commissioners spoke at the library's Earth Day event back in April and did a presentation on the benefits of community solar, which there is a residential community solar program available to all residents, and electrification, particularly focused on home appliances, convection ovens, and those things. Also looking to develop further resource guides and information for residents that were just sort of permanently linking to sort of the best resources available for residents who are seeking out information through the village. You know, there's sustainability focus on capital projects and equipment purchases. You know, we've had the EV charging station, obviously. The police department made the purchase of their own first EV, even small equipment purchases. I know our public works, as sort of older pieces of equipment, we try to update those with more battery operated equipment as older, smaller pieces of equipment retire. And then there are, I did highlight in the memo, there are some broader policy recommendations. These were pretty significant recommendations from the climate plans that would really need policy guidance from the board for. But did want to plug a few things just related to the ongoing solar efforts of the village, both at the village facility level and at the residential level. So as many of you may have received, MC Squared, who we partner with for not only our electric aggregation program, but our residential community solar program, sent out another round of postcards to promote the sign up for the residential community solar program. Mm-hmm. Again, this is an opt-in program. It can be kind of confusing because it switches people to a dual billing thing process, but it results in net savings for anyone who signs up because you're getting a credit for part of the electric generated from this solar farm that you are a subscriber to. So we're planning more communication on that and the benefits of that. In addition, last year, the board had approved our street lighting and pump station accounts to be anchor tenants of a community solar farm. That should actually be online later this year. And then on top of that, there is also rooftop solar. We have in the budget plans for rooftop solar installation at our public works garage. And then we recently looked into the Switch Together Solar Program, which is the Illinois Citizens Utility Board is partnered with the, I'm going to mess up the second, the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, I believe. And it's basically for any residents interested in installing solar panels on their rooftop, they can opt in to be part of this group buy where the Citizens Utility Board finds a local qualified contractor to basically do a group purchase for any individual residents in the Chicagoland region interested in installing rooftop solar. And so it's completely voluntary. And then their ask is just for communities to be promotional partners in this and help spread the word of this program. And that is all I've got on the presentation.
Okay. Any questions for Seth?
One comment. Just want to thank the Sustainability Commission for all the great work that they're doing, and also make a plug online on the, if you go to the LRS website, there is an online tour of their recycling facility. And I have to tell you, it's kind of amazing the equipment they have and what they can do. I shared it with the Echo Warriors at Lincoln School, because they were also very suspect of where does all of our recycling go, and it all does get used, you know, get split up. And I'm jealous that you, Susan, went in person and saw it.
Okay. You know what? I'm going to ask Seth and maybe Susan to address Trustee Brennan's question regarding the leaf blowers. I think this would be a good time because, I mean, I just wanted to get an update from you since that was a question.
Yeah, so, we took the feedback from the board. I believe that was end of October, beginning of November. I don't remember the exact date. Yep. The initial recommendation of the Sustainability Commission on that was to develop an incentive for landscape contractors to switch over, where it would not be a major financial incentive, but a rebate equivalent to their landscape license, their annual landscape license, if they commit to going all electric with their leaf blower use when operating in River Forest. And then as part of that, they would simply be listed on the sustainability portion of the website as offering this option to residents, should residents do that. We had another provision seeking to address noise, which I know is a main concern of gas-powered leaf blower use. I know the board and the president of Ducey raised some valid concerns about the enforceability of that. And then I believe you all, and I believe it was Trustee Gillis and Trustee Bachner, both raised the North Shore working group on green landscape technology. So looked into that, saw sort of the time frame, the framework they had developed. I had reached out to a couple of the communities up there. I will say the sustainability coordinator, Will Matt Lucy, was very helpful, provided a lot of information in terms of enforcement, sort of the time frame of adoption that a lot of these communities had, and a lot of them have had the seasonal bans in place for a long time. And they sort of developed a sort of second tier of seasonal ban, and then a third sort of 10-month ban window. So really use that framework. And I think what the Sustainability Commission voted on after that, and I believe it was in February, was a sort of phased in approach to that first sort of narrow summer seasonal ban, and then to develop the spring and fall windows in which gas power would still be allowed before any sort of further ban, whether it's a 10-month or a full ban. And I don't recall exactly, while leaving in place the rebate that they had initially brought to the board. So I know there's a lot of concerns. It's obviously a topic that's not going to make everyone happy.
Right.
You know, we did a lot of outreach to a lot of the landscape contractors that came in, and we've had residents come in to Sustainability Commission meetings and honestly speak on both sides of the issue. Yeah, I mean, there is a recommendation that the Sustainability Commission did vote on.
Okay.
I would personally say, and I think Susan's been a big advocate of it, at the very least, the sort of carrot approach of that rebate and the sort of promotion for the residents seeking out this information. And then, yeah, the seasonal ban, there is a recommendation, further research done on that. And we did try to sort of tailor that draft recommendation based on the feedback from those North Shore communities that they had done.
So
didn't we also say that we were going to kind of see what went on in Oak Park?
Yeah, I mean,
I think that's part of it, because I think some of the landscapers are working in both communities, and if they're converting their equipment, maybe it's not going to be such a big deal for us.
That's correct, Bob. And we did have that discussion to kind of, let's see how Oak Park kind of handles it. Not that we couldn't handle it. It just would be nice to learn from them.
Yeah.
So they just went into effect in June.
Yeah, it's been in effect for 9 days.
Right.
But I have frequent contact with Lindsay over in Oak Park.
Oh, good.
So I can, reach out to her, get some feedback. Obviously, they won't know anything yet. And she is the chief sustainability officer, not the person in charge of enforcing it. So it would be a different division over there that actually does the enforcement of it. But
so is your recommendation, or the Sustainability Commission's recommendation, now to bring it forward back to the board for discussion and vote? Is that what you're hoping
for? Absolutely. And okay. You know, we had a very modest proposal, which I think that the board correctly said, you know, this is not enough, and we agree. But if we're going to put this all in a hold, then I think it's better that we do something that's not enough than that we do nothing.
Why are we putting it on hold? I don't understand that.
Could we hold?
That's sort of the feedback that I'm hearing.
Oh, no, I think, I don't know. I never heard that. I think what we were trying to do is get, I think the only hold that I heard was, let's see how Oak Park.
That's what I'm saying. If that's what you agree on, then, at least go back to the not enough, because what we're trying to do is we're trying to signal that we're moving in this direction. Right. And so really the question is the speed. And the feedback that we got, which, we found convincing, was that landscapers, as opposed to homeowners, have said they don't have an adequate way to charge their equipment in a whole entire day. So, we accepted that, but I think we need to signal that we're moving in this direction, not like, okay, well, let's just throw this up, because technology is changing all the time and they're going to have to adapt to Oak Park.
But now we're into the season. So I don't think it's fair that we change the rules at midway in the season.
When you're talking about an incentive, then, I think that's fine.
What we had talked about when it came to our board before was not kicking this in immediately. It was having it, take effect over time. Mm-hmm. So it's not like if it came back to our board and we approved it, that it would kick in mid-season.
Exactly.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah, agreed.
And that's one of the reasons why I think waiting for Oak Park is not a good idea, because we feel like we need to give contractors adequate, they're purchasing things all the time. They need adequate. We can always change it down the line, but if we do nothing, then we're saying like, yes, just go ahead, use your.
I mean, I'm happy, unless I hear anything different, just to bring it back in July.
Absolutely. That'd be great.
For our conversation, discussion, and perhaps the vote.
Yeah, and I think the more time we can give vendors, the better, too.
Yeah.
And that's, something that we can write into the ordinance very easily. Yeah,
again, we're trying to get everybody's ideas. And so, if you, and Katie's right. I mean, it's a phase-in approach, so it's not like it's going to turn over. Yeah. But I think the thing for Oak Park for us was the enforcement, at least for me, is to see how they were going to enforce it. Now, they were going to go with a vengeance, so I don't know what that meant, reading it in the newspaper, but I would like to know what that means, No, I mean, enforcement, they're going to fine.
And the gas power generators are actually banned as part of Oak Park's proposal.
Right.
With regards to enforcement, Will Madigan did provide me with a lot of great feedback. So they enforce it equally, resident or contractor. The one provision they do have, if it's a contractor, it doesn't go to the residential household or the individual operating the machine. It goes to the contracting company, was one provision they were very clear out. And then they also had a provision whether the first time and whether it's a company or a resident is ticketed, that ticket will be waived if they can, after the fact, show proof of purchase of an electric leaf blower.
I think if you guys feel comfortable, and of course this is up to the village board too, with enforcement process. I mean, that was, I think, the big issue is you can have a law all you want, but if you can't enforce it, it's a different
story. Then in terms of time frame implementation, there were some specific dates. None that the Sustainability Commission recommended were to take effect this year.
No.
And that would be other than the incentive, correct?
Right.
And again, what that time frame is, that would be a decision for you all as the policymaking board of the village. But I think the Sustainability Commission put together a pretty good framework for that.
Okay. Well, we appreciate that. And we will then bring it to the board. I mean, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Okay. Are you staying up there, Seth? Okay. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You're still up there. It's kind of like Jack, just stays up there.
Yeah.
All right. But we like Jack too, so that's fine with me. Kate, okay, so I need a motion and a second for K2. I don't know what this is. It's still two.
No, yeah,
oh,
it's K
for motion.
Actually, it is K2. It's K22.
222.
So it's a motion to award a contract to CBell. And then in the amount not to exceed $993,226, of which the village's cost is not to exceed $343,535 after grant funding and ComEd rebates for the construction, equipment purchase, and equipment installation for the electric vehicle charging station project, and authorize the village administrator to execute the contract agreement.
Second.
Okay, Seth. Or Jack.
Yeah.
or both.
So, yeah, we were awarded a state grant through the IEPA last year to install 13 electric vehicle charging stations, a total of 18 ports. So it would be 8 direct current fast charging stations and 5 dual port level 2 charging stations. These would be at 3 village owned lots. So in working through this process, there is some electric sort of make ready work is the term used professionally to have the electricity get to the location where these chargers would be installed. So that is part of the process. Fortunately, ComEd does provide rebates for a lot of this make-ready work, so we've, gone through the process of the. This is a fully executed grant agreement with the state. There is no federal funds tied to this, so there is no risk of those funds suddenly disappearing. We have a signed, executed grant agreement, so the village or the state is already committed as long as the village fulfills the requirements of the grant. So the grant requires. For a location with level 2 chargers, that it be at least 5 dual port level 2 chargers, which would be going at the West Metro lot. And then for locations with direct current fast chargers, at least 4 chargers that can be used at the same time. Those would be going at the village owned lot over on Franklin Avenue and then the village owned lot adjacent to CVS near North Avenue.
Speak up, PC. Yeah. Okay. Get into the microphone.
Got it. So I don't know if there are any questions.
I just have a point of clarification. I think in our village notes in the agenda, I think it needs to be clear that it's the lot adjacent to CVS, not the CVS lot. Okay, because we don't own the CVS lot. We own the lot.
That is correct. Yeah, as shorthand because it's sort of immediately adjacent to it. We've referred to it just.
Yeah,
in internal speak.
I don't want somebody coming back.
There is
later on.
No, you are.
No, he's a real estate guy.
There is a specific address to the lot. It is a separate parcel of land than CBS.
Right.
I have a couple of questions.
Yep.
The Thatcher lot, the West Commuter lot,
How do those, I know residents pay to park there. Are they assigned spots or is it first come, first serve?
That lot is first come, first serve. That is only daytime parking in that lot currently. That is just for the commuter rail. And typically the east lot fills up and then it's just a small amount of overflow will go into the west lot once the east lot is full. So that location was specifically chosen because it was sort of underutilized for the location in terms of parking utilization during daytime hours. And so, then as part of the grant agreement, obviously these charging stations would be available at any time of day for use.
And I can't remember how we landed on how we deal with this EV port that we have over here by the fire station in terms of who pays for it. And I remember there was an issue about, you know, whether we kick them out after a certain amount of time or not, and there was complaints. Can you go into some detail about how the electricity is paid for and what rules there would be in these three village-owned lots?
Yes. So currently with our one electric vehicle charging station, which is a dual port level two, it is tied to the electricity here at Village Hall. We do not charge for the first 2 hours, so residents can get 2 hours of free charging with it, which can get up to about 40 to 50 miles of charge, just depending on if both ports are plugged in or not. After that, it is a prorated rate of $10 an hour, capping at $30. It's really to, that is not to raise money, but more so to encourage people to move on. I will say since that's been implemented, the average charging time, I believe, is like 1.96 hours. So
it's funny how that works.
Yes, it's effective. The problem we were seeing before that was there would be cars parked there for 8, 10, even as long as 27 hours in one instance, blocking it after being fully charged. So that is the issue that was trying to address in this specific instance. Once these are all installed and online, we would be taking a different approach and looking to recoup the cost of electricity at these charging stations. And then we would implement that universally across all charging stations. So most communities charge per kilowatt hour, which is the amount of electricity you're using there. I believe Oak Park charges 25 cents a kilowatt hour. Most communities, it's in the 15 to 25 cent range, which would fully recoup the cost of electricity and then plan for any maintenance as well for those facilities.
So are you saying that when we put these three new EV states chargers in these three new spots, we're not going to be giving the two free hours in these spots?
That would be something that would ultimately be up to the board to decide. I would strongly recommend against that for the direct current fast chargers, as those can fully charge a vehicle in 45 minutes. Typically, they get up to 80% in about 20 minutes. So those ones we would want to be charging for electricity right away. I would anticipate those are the most highly utilized. We would also likely want to have an overstay fee that took effect for those at the board's discretion to encourage those to move so those don't remain blocked after a vehicle is fully charged. The Metro lot is a different question just simply because residents are parking there for a longer time. But we would want ideally to recoup the cost of electricity if people are plugging in there, particularly every day.
Yeah, I would too. And I would like to do it here as well.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that would be the intention, is to make whatever per kilowatt hour charge to be universal. Obviously that cost would incur more slowly for people charging to level twos versus the direct current fast chargers. But sort of the amount of charge you're getting is what you're paying for.
Seth, I'm assuming there's no alarm on the charger to let you know that it's fully charged and you get a signal.
So there is, and anyone who uses it has to use the ChargePoint app. ChargePoint is the vendor we're approving purchase of. Okay. And the ChargePoint is what our existing one is. They're one of the most widely used charging station manufacturers in the country. Okay. And yeah, they will send you notifications for currently for this one when fees take effect. It says it on the screen when you seek to plug it in as well.
I'm just looking at enforcement. It might be helpful if we didn't have something like that.
Yeah, so I should say the $30 cap on the overstay fee of the prorated rate, that's equivalent to a parking ticket in the village. So that was the reasoning behind that, and that was at the recommendation of the commission.
I just want to clarify one point that Trustee Brennan brought up. So the village is not currently covering those 2 hours because that's folded into the electricity of the village, which is paid through a fee that residents pay on their gas and electric bill, or electric bill in this case. And so it's not an additional cost. So it is not currently the case that they are not covering, because the village technically is not paying an additional cost when the village is. So
the residents are, it's spread amongst all the residents.
Which it's the same fee that would be there anyway. So yeah, I mean the yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Seth, so I'm hearing you say that we are looking to recoup our costs for the electricity in this, but I'm curious about this just being revenue generating, you know, like actually making money for the village potentially. And do we know if like other towns or municipalities that do that and what that maybe looks like?
I do have a number of examples of what other communities charge for their charging rates, their overstay fees, those sorts of things. I do not know what the approach, whether it's specifically a recouping the cost of electricity versus a sort of planned source of revenue, and what the approach these other communities and sort of public charging stations have. But again, this is something that as we get closer to these being online would be something that the commission would consider and then recommend to you all for final action, so that that is codified into the village code. The current overstay fee at the our one charging station is codified into village code. That was an action that came from the commission and was brought to the board.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, any further questions for Seth? Okay, hearing no further questions or comments, I ask the clerk to take the vote.
Trustee Cascatello?
Yes.
Trustee Vasquez?
Yes.
Trustee Brennan?
Yes.
Trustee Bochner?
Yes.
Trustee O'Connell?
Yes.
Trustee Gillis?
Yes.
Okay. Great. We'll move on with the proposed tree preservation ordinance. If I can get a motion in a second.
Motion to direct the village administrator to propose a text amendment related to tree preservation to the Zoning Board of Appeals for public hearing and recommendation.
Second.
Okay. Okay, Seth.
So as I mentioned earlier, both of the USC climate plans made recommendations very specific to this. They had slightly different wording for it, but it was essentially an expansion of the village's tree preservation ordinance. So our current tree preservation ordinance is within our zoning code. It only applies to commercial, institutional, multifamily and institutional properties larger than, I believe it's 5,000 square feet is the property line, but there's very strict requirements regarding tree replacement requirements for trees that are cut down, and then there's sort of a lesser replacement requirement for those that meet certain standards of the zoning board, and then there is a more stringent requirement for the replacement of sort of, for lack of a better term, like healthy trees that don't need to be cut down. Looking at other communities, which is the first step that the Sustainability Commission took, a lot of them have very stringent requirements for single-family residential properties, tree cutting permits, very strict replacement requirements. I think the smallest or like least burdensome requirement was to plant 4 trees in place of cutting down a fully mature tree. So the Sustainability Commission, I would say, did not want to be overly burdensome on residents. Their first directive towards me was to identify specific type species of trees and particularly limit it to fully mature trees, that we could introduce a sort of first step for single family residential tree cutting limitations. Speaking with Brant Skozik, who was here earlier, a certified arborist, very knowledgeable about trees. He gave me sort of the rough estimates for fully mature trees, and specifically the two species he identified were oaks and elms. River Forest is a oak savanna. It's very crucial to the sort of ecosystem here generally, and then elms, particularly healthy, fully mature elms, should be preserved. There have been less and less of those because of the spread of Dutch elm disease. So that's another tree that, you know, the Village Parkway tree care is tracked separately than most trees along with oaks. And so it would also preserve any elm other than Siberian elm, which is an invasive species. And then, again, the Sustainability Commission not wanting to create an overly burdensome requirement on residents. If it was a dying tree, if it was a hazard, there would be no penalty or replacement requirement for the removal of these trees. If they were looking to remove a healthy tree, though, we would simply want a one-to-one replacement, and it would be any species fit for sort of the region as identified by the Morton Arboretum. So they have an extensive Northern Illinois tree planting guide. We use that guide for our parkway planting. For residential properties, it's even more expansive. So there's some trees that aren't ideal for parkway planting. I know redbud is one of them, but is great in residential yards. So this, you know, the Sustainability Commission thought this was a good first step in terms of tree preservation, and didn't want to sort of get too far out there, but did want to find some way to at least create some protection for these fully mature trees of these specific two species on single family residential properties.
And then I'd just like to point out that the action being requested from the Village Board tonight is to direct staff to present, because this code is within our zoning ordinance, it requires a text amendment process, which will require a public hearing. So the direction tonight isn't to approve an ordinance, it's to direct staff to present this ordinance to the Zoning Board of Appeals, where they will hold a public hearing, deliberate, and then make a recommendation to the Village Board.
Yes, that's correct. This would need to go through the entire zoning board process. The one additional item that Brian did raise to me, the existing tree preservation ordinance bases tree diameter 1 foot above ground level. The standard practice that arborists use is what they refer to as DBH diameter breast height, which is 4.5 feet above ground level. So it just makes a technical clarification in all the instances in the tree preservation code that reference that, just simply to reflect best practice.
Can you explain that?
So it's when measuring the diameter of the tree.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
So where, yeah. How high?
Where, yeah.
So it's from 1 foot to 4.5 feet.
That's... Gotcha. And is the intent then, if this is a mature tree that's coming down that's healthy, and they put up a young tree that's not, so if it's 20 inches, healthy tree, and that is going down, but they put up somewhere else a small tree that's only like 5 inches or 10 inches, is that an okay one-to-one?
So yeah, the sort of minimum standards for the Tree City USA, the Arbor Day Foundation, is a minimum one-to-one replacement. I was looking into see if any communities had anything less stringent than the, you know, things I had found that were provided from the climate plan. I could not find anything less stringent than a 4-to-1 replacement requirement. And again, the opinion of the commission was just to, as a first step, not be too overly burdensome on residents.
Okay. So it doesn't matter what the size of the initial.
Yeah, it would want to. I think there may be an existing provision that it needs to be 2 or 3 diameters. I'm not positive off the top of my head what it is. There is an existing provision in code how big the replacements need to be, but it's, yeah, 2 or 3 diameters. It's generally a young tree that's planted.
And just to, I guess, clarify for everybody, that would only apply to residential. So the commercial,
yeah, nothing,
and institutional will not change.
The commercial, yeah. We're keeping that exactly as it is. There are very specific requirements. That's been a process that works well. This is finding a way to take that existing process and very narrowly and in a limited manner apply that to single family properties only for these two specific species of tree.
To me, this seems like a pretty big change. And for residents who have not attended or listened to the audio for the Sustainability Commission or for us tonight, or to the Zoning Board, I'm glad to hear that it's actually going to go to the Zoning Board and there'll be a public hearing. This could be, you know, a major change for them, for those people. So I'm wondering, what are our best ways that we can publicize this to residents between tonight and the night in the zoning board public hearing and after, so that we, it's not a surprise.
Well, I mean, I think we've got our normal right channels, right, in terms of website, newsletter. Maybe we can do as part of, you know, the postcard. We can have it as, you know, one side of the postcard saying this is going to be a zoning hearing on this topic. Any other suggestions that you have in terms of other communication channels we could use? But those are what we have traditionally have available.
And Matt, correct me if I'm wrong. I believe the zoning text amendment process does require a legal ad be run for the community.
It does. There's no mailing requirement for text amendments as opposed to variations and other requests. But we could consider,
I think we should,
tying that into other mailings.
Yep. I think we should. So, I mean, if, you know, we do water bills anymore. Yeah, we do. So we can do something like that as well.
Yeah. Maybe. The idea that you would be required to put a new tree up or something on your own property, that's a big deal.
It's a big deal. Yeah. And if you come up with any other suggestions, I mean, but we'll use our traditional communication channels plus mailings will do for sure. And Megan, just for your purposes, a zoning change, I mean, we have our zoning ordinances, and from time to time, the board will change something like this or our codes, and it needs to go through a very, you know, variety of processes.
Okay, right.
And one is public hearings, and then it goes before the zoning board with hearings and so forth. And then they vote on whether it makes sense or not. And then it comes back to our board for a vote. So by affirmative vote here, you're saying, here, it's worthy to have a discussion, you know, let the zoning board continue with that discussion. If you decide not to, then we just end it here.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. I do have a couple of questions about conditions of approval. I noticed that one includes safety hazards to buildings. But I do know sometimes oak roots get into sewer lines. I don't see any protections for citizens who might have that kind of incursion, that where they're dealing with a tree. The tree is healthy, but their sewer line may not be with the tree there. Jack, you have.
So when it comes to tree roots getting into sewer lines, trees do not break sewers.
Okay.
They don't break them themselves. The only time that a tree root gets into the sewer is if there's existing cracks and moisture coming through and the trees are finding their way into the sewer line. So in situations where, because I get this call a lot, in situations where people are stating or bringing up to me that, hey, your tree broke my sewer, it's not like that. It's the sewer line has an existing deficiency. The roots are finding their way towards moisture. And the only way typically to correct this is either you rot it and then you line it to then ensure no further moisture is getting out. But it's not a situation, I would say, where the tree is coming in and the roots are breaking the line.
And so you don't think in a situation where there might be a line underneath a big tree that we'd have to take the tree down?
You would not have that situation. You would typically, like, in that case, you would either line rot it, because generally, again, the roots are only finding the moisture. Mm-hmm. So if there's no deficiency in the line, then the roots aren't creating that problem.
And you could repair a deficiency in the line without taking down the tree?
It depends on the size of the deficiency. Okay. So if,
in a situation where there was a big deficiency, where there was also a large oak tree, would that be a situation that would fall under one of these conditions of approval, or does it not?
So in that situation, obviously we'd look at every option that's available.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's potentially room in the parkway to move or slightly adjust the line to make it work, that's what we would prefer to do, just because an oak tree takes a very long time to grow to get to where it needs to be. So we would look to see if there that adjustment could be made. The absolute last resort would be cutting down a tree.
Okay. I want to make sure we're not putting undue hardship onto our residents, particularly our seniors or people in smaller homes, with something that's onerous or that might be, in their case, having those interactions. So I just want to make sure that as we're considering this, that we're also considering a hardship exemption for people who might.
The existing language, Section E of the conditions of approval does reference without causing unreasonable economic hardship. So there is a provision that
there would be a discretion
yep.
available. Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Seth, I would just ask that take a look at the current language and the proposed language. In both, there's some language that's not gender neutral. It refers to the zoning administrator being a man. So let's just fix that when we set it on.
Absolutely.
Yep. Thanks.
No, he is. Today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
All right, any further questions for Seth? All right, hearing none, I'll go ahead, Rosa, if you mind taking the vote.
All right.
Yes.
Trustee Vasquez?
Yes.
Trustee Brennan?
Yes.
Trustee Bachner?
Yes.
Trustee O'Connell?
Yes.
Trustee Gillis?
Yes.
Trustee Cascatello?
Yes.
Okay, so we're up. I need a motion to approve the switch. Solar program partnership.
Motion to direct the village administrator to propose text amendments related.
No.
Motion to approve participation in the Switch Together solar program, including the use of the village logo and marketing materials, and to feature information about the program in the village website.
Second. Okay.
So I briefly touched on this earlier. This is a program run through the Citizens Utility Board of Illinois and the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. No cost to the village, no obligation for residents to participate. You would have to, we would simply promote the program. If residents were interested, they would voluntarily sign up, at which point a contractor has been selected as part of one of these reverse auctions is the term they use to host it. The resident would be then sent an offer, which they could then accept if they wanted to utilize that vendor to install rooftop solar. Mm-hmm. These are local vendors that are vetted to make sure they have all of the right state certifications and qualifications for solar panel charging. I did, in my brief communication with MREA, indicate we do have a local contractor licensing requirement for solar rooftop solar installation. They didn't seem to just like sort of basically acknowledge that and acknowledge that that's how most communities operate. So this would simply be promotional material. The Sustainability Commission had discussed this. Their one concern was just to make sure everything was okay if we are using the village logo in promoting this program. And like I said, it's endorsed by the Citizens Utility Board of Illinois.
I think there's a little bit of chatter going on this one already out on the street. And this one might be one where you want to have a community meeting and bring the people in, explain everything that's going on, and have people come. So there's no conflict that we're involved in or whatever, and have them, the vendor provided services, the process, the cost, everything associated with it. So
is it this one? I thought it was
there's a
couple. There were some other providers and
I think that one's still causing confusion too, so
which is amazing because it's been going on for years. Okay, I mean,
Bob, are you saying that like the program has the people already in place, the vendors already in place, so it's not a fair?
No, I think people are just asking if this is another program that they have to get involved in with an electric company or the solar company or whatever.
Is it legit?
Is it legit? I think is kind of it. So I think,
right.
Yeah, this would not be related to anyone's sort of regular utility bills. This would be finding and selecting a contractor to do rooftop solar installation on their property. They would need to voluntarily sign up for it, and then they would need to later voluntarily complete that contract and go through the standard village permitting process to do that rooftop solar installation.
So, Bob, I think you're, I mean, well, as long as we have our logo, maybe the email has to be a Village River Force email, because that what creates a lot of the suspicious.
Yeah, and I don't believe we were planning on doing any email promotion. It would simply be website, social media, newsletter, just like.
Like on the marketing material that I'm saying.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, or, you know, just go back to our website. Is that what it's going to say? Okay.
Does it make sense to maybe, I mean, again, this gets, I think, a separate from this vote. There's a lot of different ways that, I mean, the whole solar business is pretty complex. If you think about community aggregation, then you have community solar, then you have solar on your roof. Does it make sense to separately, I'd recommend maybe have, see if we can come up with a chart for village residents that says, okay, here's all the different ways you can harness the sun, right? Here's this way, pros and cons, this way, pros and cons, this way, pros and cons.
Great. Yeah. And I believe there may be some existing things similar to that out there. But I think that's a great idea. I think we can easily incorporate that into you know, a lot of the communications the Sustainability Commission does. You know, I know with MC Squared, you mentioned there's a lot of confusion because they have both the electric aggregation program and the community solar program. One of which is an opt-out program, one of which is something you have to sign up for, get put on a list, and then sign up for again once you get sent an offer. So there's certainly a lot of confusion in explaining these various programs and the benefits of these various programs. So yeah, I can certainly do a better job in helping communicate that and getting that information out there.
You know, I think you're doing a fine job, but I think just seeing it like in an easy to read chart. Yep. Look, it is complex. We're trying to make it simple for you, but here are the different ways.
Yeah.
It just might go a long way to address some of the issues, Trustee O'Connell, that you're seeing out there.
Yeah. And I don't think we should ever have an opt out program. I think that's what confuses people. I think if people want to do it, we should lay it out to them and let them opt in. So I think that we get into a lot of trouble there.
Yeah. I want to get in trouble. All right. Any other further questions for Seth? Okay, hearing none, let's go ahead and take that vote, please.
Trustee Brennan?
Yes.
Trustee Bachner?
Yes.
Trustee O'Connell?
Yes.
Trustee Gillis?
Yes.
Trustee Cascatello?
Yes.
Trustee Vasquez?
Yes.
Okay. Then last and final Sustainability Commission, item five. If I can get a motion and a second on item five.
Motion to waive formal bidding due to competitive quotation and award a 36-month electricity supply contract for the pumping station and street lighting with AEP Energy Incorporated not to exceed the price of 0.06 cents per kilowatt hour and authorize the village administrator to execute the contract agreement.
Second.
Okay.
So our pumping station and our street lighting accounts are not covered by the ComEd utility franchise fee. We have to every so often basically bid out purchase where we purchase the energy from for these because they are not part, they cannot be part of the standard sort of ComEd billing process or utility franchise fee. This has been process for more than 10 years looking back through files I have available to me. Since 2021, these accounts have been on 100% renewable energy. That is primarily through wind renewable energy credits. The last one was a 12-month extension that goes through this December that was enacted, I believe, last fall or maybe even the fall before. At the time, a 12-month was done because the pricing was lowest for 12-month contracts. From the pricing sent, and I did include a sample from a couple weeks ago, pricing is now lowest for a 36-month contract. The price in that quote was only 1.3% increase from our current electric rate. This does give a little bit of fluctuation because these quotes come in at new rates daily. But basically this December, once this current contract is up, this would lock in an electricity rate for these two accounts for the next 3 years.
Seems reasonable to me. Any questions from anybody? Okay. Yeah, that was pretty fast. So hopefully Katie gets back.
I was going to say run the pumping station at night when the rates are really low.
Exactly. No water for you today. Rates are too high. All right. Let's call Katie Black.
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. Okay. Trustee Bachner?
Yes.
Trustee O'Connell?
Yes.
Trustee Gillis?
Yes.
Trustee Cascatello?
Yes.
Trustee Vasquez?
Yes.
And we'll wait for trust. Yeah.
One meeting we don't have it.
Yeah. Dang. All right. What, I don't know. What's the process? If she misses a vote, she misses a vote.
No, he was out of the room.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Very good.
It passed
anyway, but I just want to make sure. All right. Thank you, Seth. Appreciate it. All right. So never happened to me before. Oh, there's Katie.
Oh, there you go.
So Katie, we just voted.
We'll get your vote when you...
If you get here really quick, you can vote. Hit it.
Okay.
We just didn't want to not include you. So, okay. So let's move on to unfinished business, which is a continuation of the discussion of the fire alarm and sprinkler system alarm notification that Tom and Carrie brought up last month, mm-hmm. I think. I can't remember. And so I asked both chief and the deputy chief to go through the discussion, if that's okay with you guys. Okay.
Yeah. So I'd like to start out with just some past history and education. Just many of us weren't here at the time when a lot of this took place, but in 2006, the village passed an ordinance requiring residential automatic fire protection sprinkler systems in residences, existing homes that were renovated more than 50% or more had to sprinkler their residence. They also at that time required that the fire protection sprinkler system be monitored by a company called ADS. Since that time, in 2018, that ordinance was revised, increasing the requirement for a sprinkler if 90% of the residence was being renovated. And also the monitoring portion of the requirement was dropped. So residential sprinkler systems were no longer required to be monitored. So since then, we ended up having an incident in town recently where there was some confusion as to why their system activated but did not notify the dispatch center. So education, another point of education I'd like to put out there is many of the residents in River Forest, their houses are covered by smoke detectors that are hardwired and hardwired together, but they are separate from the sprinkler system. So if both of those systems are not being monitored, the fire department will not get notified unless it's done by through a 911 call. That's why we recommend that if smoke detectors that are hardwired in your residence, that be monitored. It's not required. You can use any vendor you want. But that's where we are right now. So we went back after this most recent incident. We contacted ADS. They gave us the names and addresses of the residents that are still currently being monitored, and we are going to reach out to them through a mailing from a letter that we put together explaining their systems, how they work, and just to kind of inform them that if they're not paying for their smoke detectors to be monitored or their sprinkler system to be monitored, we will not get notified unless they make a 911 call. The reason they were required to be monitored back in 2006, I believe that it was basically if you weren't home and knew your sprinkler system was going off, there was no way that the fire department would be notified unless you were being monitored. Or if you were injured or incapacitated at the time, we would not get notified other than through a phone call. So that's where we are today. So that's what we're going to do to try to we've already sent out some information in at least one newsletter, maybe two, Matt, I'm not sure, but I know we did one for sure with some of this information explaining. And if residents have any questions about their sprinkler system or smoke alarms or any type of system you may have in your residence, we urge them to call our fire marshal directly, and he'll be more than happy to either come out or talk to you over the phone and get you up to speed on where you're at with your systems. So,
Chief, as part of the outreach to the residents who currently have contracts with this third party, are you also going to advise those residents, or are we also going to be advising those residents that the village has changed its code and we no longer require that?
Sure. That will be in there. Yep.
And we are also are reaching out to the other providers. Since that ordinance was changed in 2018, residents can use other alarm providers to monitor their services. So we're still collecting that information from those other entities so that we can expand that mailing for those that might be with different providers.
Yeah, there's many different vendors out there. We've reached out to at least six of them that I'm aware of. So we're still getting information from those vendors as well. So
why did we require residents to just use this one entity?
Because at that time, their ADS was in Westcom. They had a board in Westcom at that time that no longer exists. That was removed. That was one of the reasons that they dropped the requirement, is because ADS was pulling that system out of Westcom. So that's why ADS was the preferred vendor. It would go straight directly to Westcom instead of going through a central station. Right.
Which is the 911 center.
Right. I'm sorry. Yeah. Westcom is our 911 center. So, yeah, that was the reason why.
Yeah, Tommy, you come on up. Yeah, because I know this is a. Yeah, please.
Sure.
Come to the podium, because you need. It's, as Katie reminds us, people are watching remotely. We just need to make sure they can hear us.
And people also listen to the audio afterwards, and they want to hear. It's really frustrating when it's just silent for a while, and we make comments about something that people on the audio couldn't hear.
In some of my research now, I realize companies like to use their own smoke detectors. And when I talked to ADS, our 110-volt system, they believed it could not be wired into their communication system. But the good news, APT is going to save the day. And they're going to use sensors that we already have, and they're going to add their own smoke detectors, and it will go to their dispatch center, and then we'll call you. Okay. But we're not able per se to tie our 110-volt system into
the ADS system.
Right. Is that true? True statement?
That's probably true, yes.
Okay.
Because each company is unique. Each vendor,
yeah,
with what detectors they use and those type of things. So yeah,
okay, all right. So that's
wired system cannot run by any.
Yeah. So
correct.
That's,
mm-hmm. So if you have a hardwired smoke detector in your house and you want it monitored, most likely when you call the vendor that's going to monitor it, they'll put in their own smoke detector to do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll get in touch with those people.
Yep. We'll get in touch with. So kind of a bad situation helped others. But
any other questions?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. I appreciate it. And thank you, Tom Carey, for waiting this long to have this conversation. It was unfinished business. So I was trying to move through it. Now you know a lot about our sustainability. So, tree ordinance. So thank you.
Carrie used to be on the sustainability commission.
I know. I appointed. I know it. So, all right. So let's move on to some new business, which is the presentation of our water system.
Okay, so this is a presentation on our water system, overall utility from us getting the water out of the lake all the way to your house.
Yeah.
Okay. So there we go. There we go. So Village River Forest, we have approximately 11,200 people. We serve residences, businesses, as well as public, private, secondary and tertiary educational institutions within the village. We purchase our water in bulk from the city of Chicago. Okay. Our municipal system is owned and operated by the village. We have three system interconnections. Our main one is to the city of Chicago, which is where we purchase our water from. And we have two emergency connections, one with the village of Oak Park and one with the village of Forest Park. In any emergency situations, we can pull water from them, but also provide water to them if anything happens. The main components of our system, approximately 39.5 miles of transmission and distribution water main that ranges from 2 inches to our biggest one being 20 inches. We have one pump station with three pumps and two ground level reservoirs, 500,000 gallon and a 2 million gallon that's divided into two 1 million gallon pieces. And then one elevated water storage tank that's located at our public works facility. Now it works. Okay. So water supply and distribution overview. As I mentioned previously, we purchase our water in bulk from the city of Chicago. The water that we get is from the Jardine Water Purification Plant that's located just north of Navy Pier, right off of Ohio Street. It is the largest purification plant in the world. They pull in 1 billion gallons per day. The village takes possession of this water at Harlem and North. That's where we have our vault where we take in the water, and it is conveyed then through a 16-inch pipe over to our pump station. The other way. There we go. So here we have an overall view of our water distribution system. I like to, joke with the guys that these are the veins. And then we have our three pumps and we have our elevated storage tank that gets the water to all the different residences throughout town. As Trustee Gillis mentioned a little earlier, sometimes we have emergencies, we have breaks. I'd like to say that based on our history, it's not too bad. FY23, we had 6 breaks, 24, we had 8 breaks, 25, we had 7. This year, unfortunately, we're off to a bad start with 2. But I will say, based on our history, we do keep track of where all the breaks occur. We had a water system and hydrologic model completed in 2018 that provides an overview of our entire system and basically sets for us an example of where we should start attacking and start doing systematic replacement. I'd also like to mention that as part of our CIP process, over the next 5 years for water distribution improvements, so that's particular to water main, we have $2.975 million towards water system enhancements, or just the water main improvements.
Thanks.
Okay. So here we have a schematic of really how this water comes in. As I mentioned previously, our intake is over at Harlem and North. You have the Chicago Water System supply. Then it goes over to the pump station. When it gets over to the pump station, we go into our 500,000 gallon, million gallon reservoir along with our 2 million gallon reservoir. Our pump station is located over at Jackson and Berkshire. We can pump with our three pumps 8.48 million gallons per day. Our booster pumps draw the water in from the suction well. That's just after those two reservoirs where we meter and chlorinate it prior to it leaving the pump station and entering into our distribution system. All pumps are controlled by our village's supervisory control and data acquisition, SCADA. Our SCADA system is what can remotely monitor our system to see if everything's operating as it should. Brian and Mike, who were here earlier, they get immediate alerts if there is something going on or something that's not proper, and somebody comes in and goes and makes the adjustment or calls in the reinforcements as required. One interesting fact is that the village generally runs on three main configurations based on the time of the year. Pump number one runs as our lead pump from fall to spring. Pump number three runs as our lead during the spring. And pump number two is our biggest pump. And we have that running during the summer months because of irrigation systems. Also at our pump station, we do have a large 475 kilowatt diesel power generator. So if there's ever a power outage village-wide, you will still have water. Our small reservoir is 500,000 gallons, along with our large reservoir that's 2 million gallons. Both reservoirs were built around 1929. That is not something to be necessarily concerned. We have our reservoirs every 5 years inspected. We recently had them inspected this year. Based on preliminary reports, they're in very good condition. So they're in very good condition. And those are massive pieces of infrastructure that we have. Thank you. So here is what I've said previously, which is our SCADA. So this is our ability to remotely monitor and control our village-wide water system. Those little line charts that you see above, those based on their pattern allows us to see whether or not there's a water main break, whether or not there's something happening. We also see the levels in the tank, and we also see the levels in the tower. Levels in the tower and the tanks, particularly the tower, allows us to gauge the pressure within the system and whether or not we need to activate or turn on, turn off any of our pumps. So one of the interesting facts is before the introduction of SCADA, we would actually be required to have a team member come in and check in every so often. We have we actually kept it for sentimental value. In the pump station, we have a little disc that actually used to run wires to show whether or not everything was operating correctly. That's turned off now because we have obviously this remote monitoring, but it would basically be like a little pencil that was writing on a circle and it would show us whether or not everything was operating properly. We also have the original well when we used to be on well water. So we don't do that anymore though. The well is right in the middle. We just kept the stand. The hole has been filled in.
Mm-hmm.
But the pump station is actually near where we used to actually draw our own water from aquifers.
I should go back.
Am I going the wrong way? Yes, I am. Okay, elevated storage tank. So, as many of you may know, our elevated storage tank is located right behind our Public Works garage at 45 Forest Avenue. The tank is a Chicago Bridge and Iron Steel single pedestal water spheroid constructed in 1983. with a maximum usable storage volume of 500 gallons. The main thing to understand why a lot of communities and everywhere, why you see the elevated storage tank, it's really used to control system pressure. So if we didn't have a storage tank, our pumps would be running constantly to keep us at a particular pressure. And it'd be it'd be more challenging to make sure that we vary on, vary off our pumps to make sure we stay at a certain pressure. By having the elevated storage tank, all we're doing is our pumps only cycle on when we have to get to a certain elevation to be able to keep the pressure within our system. So the elevated storage tank is really a big energy saver because we're using gravity to create the pressure rather than just mechanical pressure. Okay, so the current number of customers in River Forest is 11,172. Dividing by the annual pumpage value, that really approximates to 109 gallons per capita per day. In 2021, the village started the AMI, Automatic Metering Infrastructure Project, and the associated customer portal. This project delivers increased customer service by providing billing based on consumption that can be seen in real time with meter reads occurring daily. It also helps identify any irregularities in water usage, such as leaks being experienced by residents within the home and irrigation system. As part of this AMI project, a product called WaterSmart was implemented. This web-based software allows each account holder to see their current and past meter reads, set up proactive notifications based on desired thresholds, and provide assistance in troubleshooting any leaks or level of consumption that are higher than desired. This product is free for all customers, and it's available on our village website. We use this WaterSmart technology. I know our water department helps residents all the time with troubleshooting and being able to find issues within their home, typically humidifiers, toilets, different things around the house that residents don't realize until they have a really high water bill. But this is something that does come in handy all the time. It works both ways. Residents get notifications, but we do as well. Our staff does reach out proactively to residents sometimes asking either, do you have something big going on or is this a problem? And we work with them to try to troubleshoot it.
That's great. You know that.
And then our best, most fun topic, lead service lines. This is definitely part of our water infrastructure. Mm. So the Village of River Forest has compiled our initial inventory that was required to be complete by April of 2024. We submitted our second draft in April of 2025, and we will have to continue to submit drafts until 2027 is when they're required to be our final inventory. Aside from known properties, we use GIS to compile the initial inventory of service lines. We also, the village does provide a cost share program to facilitate the replacement of the lead service lines throughout the village. In terms of even our proactive inventory, to date, we've had 517 people that have answered our survey. We always encourage people that, you know, to answer our survey. We also have been proactively potholing. We've started that a couple weeks ago to try to mix that in with our regular sewer maintenance. So this is where we're currently at. So of the 3,185 connections, I can say that at this time, based on the data and information that we have, 27% of our system is verified as not lead, 21 is verified as lead, and we still have 52% that we currently have as unknown that we continue to try to either address either as potholing or get people to answer the survey. So that is something that we continue to push.
Jack, can you explain a little bit what potholing looks like?
So what we've started for potholing, we are lucky to have a Vactor sewer truck. So that Vactor truck allows us to minimize the size of the hole that we create. So instead of, you know, coming out and trying to take either a backhoe or shovels and where you have a hole that's substantial in the parkway, this machine allows us to make a mechanical hole that's really like only a foot in diameter and allows us to go straight down the 4.5-5 feet to get to the service line so that we're able to identify what the material is. So we're doing that, trying to do that proactively, trying to pick out blocks that really have a stretch of unknown so that we can just start addressing and trying to fill up our inventory. We've been finding, so I want to be clear, we're not finding just lead. We're finding actually a lot of copper, a lot of lead. It's a mixed bag, and we're really just trying to identify everything that we have. I think that's it. That's why. Okay. Are there any questions?
We covered by the Great Lakes Water Compact.
Great Lakes Water Compact in terms of how much water are allowed to use. So we, our village, every year from the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, I get a letter of how much water we are allowed to use. And we are not at that point. IDNR, Illinois Department of Natural Resources, sorry, not IEPA, IDNR. But we are allocated a certain amount of water, and we're not allowed to go over that. We're not near our allocation.
So Jack, I got one question, and obviously we get our water from Chicago today. I understand it. In 3 years, there is a where water will be getting water from. I don't know if it's McCook. I heard that it's moving to another area, that we're not going to, the source of water won't come from Chicago. Does that make any sense?
So in 2030, so we attend the quarterly meetings from the Chicago Water Advisory Council.
Right.
Those in 2030, they are supposed to provide us a new funding model.
Yeah.
Whereas they will show how each individual customer should be paying for their individual water. That will not change where we get our water from. There are two main reservoirs that Chicago pulls to send to their major purchasers. We are Jardine, the northern one. There's also a southern one, but we will stay as part of Jardine.
Okay, I got to find out more. Yeah, right. That might be it, but I was talking to someone, I can't remember where, but I got the impression that in 2030, yes, that actually our water, because of where we're getting it from, would actually, the cost of it would go down.
Way that Chicago has explained it, or their technical guidance, is that by 2030, that they are supposed to come out with a fair funding model the board.
Yeah.
Because currently we've just been locked in a rate.
Right.
And every year it's just been consumer price index increase.
Or whatever Chicago wants. Right.
Correct. So we're supposed to get most favored nation status along with other people. Like, there's a whole thing about just in terms of long-term customers and what they should be billed.
Okay. Well, so we might get some reprieve. We'll see. All right. Thank you. This is very, very nice. Any questions for Jack? Okay. Thank you, Jack. Appreciate it. Okay. That ends our regular meeting. We will go into executive session. So I'd ask if we can move into executive session. Motion.
Motion to enter into executive session pursuant to 5 ILCS 120(2)(c)(2) to discuss collective negotiating matters between the public body and its employees or their representatives, or deliberations concerning salary schedules for one or more classes of employees, and the village board will adjourn after executive session and will not return to open session.
Second.
Okay, very good. Okay, so we're going to move into executive session as soon as we can.
Okay.
Yep. Yes. Please take the vote.
Yeah.
Great. Take the vote, yep.
Trustee O'Connell?
Yes.
Trustee Gillis?
Yes.
Yes.
Trustee Kiscatello?
Yes.
Trustee Vasquez?
You say Vasquez? Yes.
Trustee Brennan?
Yes.
And Trustee Brockner?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right.